outside of the jury's home door. It was 1:50. The date was April the 13th, and we do have a forum to conduct business consisting of myself sitting around the water, my vice chair, Senator Kenneth Conkle, Senator Lee Costello, and Senator Bill Mulkowski. The items we have on the agenda today, Senator Mulkowski, Bill 27, is Representative Lance Sayer showed up in person. We'll hear that, and we're going to be working on the version S. That is just come to us, he is with the staff, Mike Carver. Then we're going to bring to House Bill number 308. We have Lindsay in the room to present on behalf of the majority of the member in the House. And then we're going to Senate Bill number 187, arson, motor vehicle. Jesse Peel will present on behalf of Senator Egan. And then we will go to Senate Bill number 212. By the Senate Judiciary Committee and Forrest Wolf will present that. And then we're going to wrap up the House Bill number 8. We'll adopt working version L. And then we'll present on that. Okay? So without further ado, Representative Gadd, tell us about House Bill 27, please.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your consideration. I'll take your cue from you on how fast you'd like me to go in terms of testifying as we the children's trust of course the bill, but they have a letter in the packet, so they chose not to testify just to save time that this for itself and we probably want to testify. So if you would like me to go through that, what are the reasons for the bill? The biggest thing I'd like you to think about is most children are vulnerable, and that's our goal. And we are the guardians of those children who we take out of their homes and put in foster care, who are the legal purpose. The question is, what kind of home do we want them to have as their partners? But we want to have a loving home, and in the world of foster care, that's called permanency, a permanent home. It's a technical word, doesn't raise a lot of passion, but a permanent home exists, means getting a job out of foster care. People think, you want a foster care system that's great in foster care. We want it now. And the statistic that's sobering is we rank second to last in the nation in, for example, in the number of youth who are ready to be adopted, who are just sitting currently right in the foster care system. We have 700 youth just waiting to be adopted on a per capita basis, only Oklahoma, of course. There are many states, Wyoming, 381 children, or at least on the population. That just gives you a sense. Leaving children to leave in a foster care system or to bounce between is making probably very good a woman in Galloway, who went through 47 foster homes. Somehow, through all of that, is not at the University of Las Vegas. And my point really is, you shouldn't have to be a hero in order to survive the foster care system. It should be a survival process and a good process for children who even aren't, don't even rise to that level of hero status. A bill has a few things. It uses the current, right now we know they're very young social workers, so it's a very hard job. There was a lot of women actually have a social work degree. They're caseworkers, they come in, they get training, they realize how hard the job is, how stressful it is, and they leave often within a year. And they don't get to master the 508 policy manual. You can't blame them for that. But some of the things that they're just not able to do are the most important. And so we have a double check, a safety check, to make sure that some of the most important things happen. Number one, we want to get you to a permanent home. So the bill requires that during the regular staff hearings, when a caseworker shows up, that they show the court that they've engaged in reasonable efforts to get you a permanent home. Now, often it's just showing that they've done the family research to see if there's a grandmother or an uncle or an aunt, a family member will take the child in. That would be the best thing possible. But we know sometimes the caseworkers don't actually even do a family search. But they should. There's an SCS policy they need to. But since it doesn't always happen, we want to clerk during the status hearings to ask what have you done to bring the child into a permanent home. If a very young caseworker with too big of a caseload says, you know what, I really haven't done anything, the court says, go ahead, come back in 20 days. So the family, you know, the family says, well, no. But a young, two brothers, 16 years old, they were 16. been prosecuted our whole lives before any case or found out that we had a grandparent, I am denial. And so at every place we change, and God forbid there are a lot, but we know that there are a lot, 10, 20 places we change for some reason. Every place we change, we strive to make sure that their family search is updated so that they know where the reason is out there, or an uncle, or a grandmother. So we have a lot of culture persistent. They intended to do that internally as a matter of policy, but we know that the caseworkers are too often too young. And other people did not want to know all those things. Another part of the bill is Alaska has joined the Casey Family Foundation, founded by the owner of UBS, the founder of UBS. He took foster care on as a big issue. And then another child advocate group sort of said, you want to have children in foster care if they need to be. They all say at age 21, he said, well, there's no way, but I know 35% of them have been jailed at some point. Roughly 40% of them are in the homeless or job shifting. That's not the result they want. If they're not ready to leave foster care, please don't dump them out of foster care when they're not ready. Right now, up to 18 a court before they say it's okay to the social worker to let them out of foster care system on their own. They ask us if the child's best interest. But they don't ask them if you're 19 or if you're 20 and still in foster care. And sometimes youth are exited from foster care. Too young, they're not ready, and then they end up homeless, or they end up in jail, or they end up with the wrong car. And all we're asking in this bill is at the very least, yes, where the judge decided it's showing in the child's best interest that they're going to be on their own. And so that also uses the existing current hearing status schedule. So the judge is able to do something. Those are two of the most important parts of the bill, the family searches. The requirement that a social worker be able to show that they're judged, they've done something on permanency, or what's feasible, given their caseload, and these are feasible. Other parts of the bill that are important, but track now federal law and interim OCS policy is easy. A lot of these, unfortunately, bounce between homes. They're going to bounce them into the house. You cause more emotional damage, and you cause more neglect, and you cause more resentment, and you cause more distrust for adults. But when you bounce children between homes, sometimes you bounce them between schools. And one thing, where you are in algebra in the center of the hospital is not where you're in algebra in every school that you're going to move to. And so the national standard is that now Congress needs to pass a law, but not easily enforceable in the state courts. It says if it's in the child's best interest, you're trying to keep them in the same school and they're in the same municipality. So when they move from the south to the Idaho district in Anchorage, and you can keep them in the same school, it's in their best interest to keep them in the same school because every school counts, especially for an older child, moves a child 4 months behind in their education on average. And you do that 5 times, and it's 4 months, and all of a sudden, what do you have in your school? It's about creating some stability in terms of the lives that are up there.
And on that point, there's different evidence on that, but the most important thing is stability. And if you don't have it in the family unit already, you need it in the school. Because there is so many evidence that shows that very stable families can move kids in those schools. But you're dealing with kids that don't have the inner stability around them, right?
Thank you. That's exactly right. Children are very uprooted. They gather in a new family, and now they're in a different part of the housing class. There are many cases where moving between schools will be okay. The question is, do you just make sure OSS determines it's in their best interest in those schools? And that's the federal law now. But the only, of course, the federal law is it doesn't protect the child. If you don't want to have the federal law, you just lose the federal funding. So if you put it in a state statute, it makes you something that's enforceable. There is one other really important part of the bill. I'm trying to get this as quick as possible. There's one other really important part of the bill that OCS has asked for. Sometimes the child is not ready to leave foster care. They're at the university, or they're in a vocational training program. And let's say they're housing in this training program or at the university. But they still have a foster family to come back to during Saturday and summer for Christmas to maintain contact with for support. The family, when they're in the program, and they have $30 per day foster care rate, that's fine. But technically, OCS can't keep the child in foster care and let them live in a dorm because that's not what ICE is supposed to do. And so, we'll have a provision in the bill that allows OCS to my childhood, or why are foster care if they still need to be in foster care? Because right now it's illegal. If you imagine that it's illegal for your child to go to college and move into your parent, I will say that in roughly 20 states, families, children with conventional parents are now staying at home to age 21 in roughly 20 states on average. And you understand that, but your child has the best ability, nobody to look after them, nobody to rely on. Those children might need it a little bit more. Those are the big parts of the bill. There is a small part of the bill that is a pet peeve of mine. I did not know specifics of these, but in a part of the statute that governs children who are older than 16 years and older, the law right now says OCS should help them get a basic education, long-term basic college. And I think you should have told people about a basic education. And so we need to change the work. A lot of other committees change that work too. They should help with education or vocational training. And not define the level of it, but the word basic sort of reminds you of the Charles Dickens case, and we should do better than that. Those are major parts of the deal that I want. We also asked the department when they have time, when they're in front of a group of 200 people who might be very interested in helping, to let them know if they have children or foster families, which we do, or children or adopted families, which we do. The director or HICOMEDOS here, so when they're in front of the group, can do the pitch and say, look, we have a shortage. Anybody who wants to step up to help, say, there's a flyer, here's how you do it. Doesn't cost anything. I do it myself when I go to Rotaries and Chambers and Conferences. So we just stick that on the local communities. They don't have to spend any money on it unless they have front-grade money. But they can. They have much more access to bigger crowds than you and I do on a more frequent basis. And so we had that duty yesterday morning that we were trying to figure out something very clear on the record. This is not a thing that we want you to spend money on. But when you're in front of these crowds, they take advantage of it and make a pitch. And the government can do that too. So that's really the bill. I would say to call this again, which will be less than Trump has stressed it, since I'm not here, is that this bill will help reduce the impact of trauma by taking steps to get youth out of foster care into loving homes. It reduces human sentences for diverse childhood experiences and builds resilience among the last student. I'm trying to go as fast as I could because I know your time pressed. Is there any questions? I think we have one person on the line.
Thank you, Officer Mayor. Thank you for personalizing your life experience and being vulnerable enough to allow it to make meaningful change in the state of lesbian policy. Conversations many of us have about how much of yourself you share and let it become part of your advocacy work, and you yourself having been a foster child and being vulnerable enough to share that story has changed hearts and minds and has opened up what should happen. And of course, people who are very passionate about this subject that wouldn't have otherwise even known or understood how important it is. So I appreciate it, and your bonding, and your determination, you showed right up, and as a result of that first, and so I compliment you for that. I also wanted to say that one of the things that has, in my years of healing, continued to frustrate me is that there has been, generally speaking, more pro-life mandate from the time that I served in the House and the Senate organizations. And we do deal with and have dealt with a lot of legislation, me personally as well as Judiciary Chair, navigating the Constitution on the subject of abortion. And so I would say if I had to summarize it, the mandate over the last 16 years and longer as far as health care has been that every life counts and matters. And yet, there seems to be so much focus on in utero life and not once the life is born. It's bothered me. This gentleman to my left is not inconsistent about that. He's committed to all the lives. But I think this is a really important step to think about that. If our policy is going to be that every life matters and we prefer people to get life, then we need to find ways knowing that children don't choose their parents. But it's the child that we're going to make sure has a great chance at life. and this bill, could put it in for a long way. I'd like to see some for 992. I think one of their best bills was social worker to the last immigration. And I think at some point it'd be nice to look at that and maybe if it's a foundation grant or something else can help us go a long way. Because I think your earlier comments really are on the basis of, cost size and bargaining and items like Barbara, you just know that the system is just maxed out. And 9 out of 10 times, it is the younger person who has the hardest living. They want to do the best they can to earn the amount. Not a whole lot of life experience themselves, but on top of it, they have so many people they're trying to take care of, so many kids. So I think this goes a long way, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. I know it's all been up to the members, but
thank you, Representative Kerr, for bringing this before us. So I just need to chat with you for a minute with our state. It looks like even they say, as far as the numbers of foster care children under the age, it is insane for growth. And it looks like in Maryland in 2005, they had almost 2,000 kids in the foster care system, and now they have less than 500. I was wondering, do you know if Maryland, if there's something that Maryland did that they were able to reduce that number?
As a parent, I know it's hard because you're all huge children's advocates, so I appreciate this. Everyone here. It's a really good point. I recognize that because I don't know what they've done. They've done very well. And it's worth me trying to find out. And so I should take this on a project for me. And please reply to that.
Consider all interns, I'm sure you have, and I know that Tracy Campbell is online from OCS. Interns, law students, looking to do comments and notes, bring as much volunteer power as you can in some of these places and see if we can move our state out of that statistic that you talked about. It's going to require.
That's right. Thank you. I think there's many good things in here. So I like the active efforts and encourage your time. I think that. Under NICLA, for example, we have to do active efforts. This kind of lines it up. And I mean, if you even know under NICLA, they kind of go in the tribal group. This is at least one of the foster care or potential. I think the active efforts are great. I think there are many things you do. There's a couple of questions I wanted to ask you on how you got where you're at right now. So on page 7, the new section you have in part of section 5, I just need to. The interview where the department told me that we're not increasing license requirements. So this piece of foster care licensing requirements is the last part of that sentence around line 10 and 11. Is this a new requirement that we are looking to apply for, or are we being consistent with what we have in the existing study anymore?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's not the provision you're talking about when I was talking about the license. This is part of the effort that when the department bounces a kid from one home to another home to another home, we just want to make sure that your family services being completed. So we know if there's a grandmother or an aunt or an uncle, this is part of the permanency protocol. And so this one just says, is there an adult out there that meets a family friend, a family member? Is there an adult out there that meets the foster care licensing requirements? We don't change them. It's the same licensing requirements. And this is looking to make sure that your family and family friend search is complete. Those OCS is intent, that's their internal policy. But, so that's not part of the part that you remember. I just want to make sure it's consistent guidelines because I don't want the families to have to be licensed. If that's the issue at hand, I agree if we're transferring from one foster care to another, as a state trustee, I'd like to see that they're licensed to them. I agree with that part. So I just want to make sure we were creating another version of families.
I'm sorry, I gave you a question. You're right, Russ. I'll say no problem. I'll just see if there's any work to do
with this. No, we don't change any of the licensing requirements. If you're a relative placement, you don't have to be technically a foster parent.
And they don't have to go through the same licensing requirement as an unrelated family. You still do a criminal background check. You still do a check for the basis of the best interest of the child. It's a little bit of a lower level as far as Campbell case initiative. But we do want you to see if there are family members or family friends at the center of those justices. That would be a good placement for the child, but we don't change any of those requirements. It is a lower level of licensing requirement for a family member. Still a strong one, though, but we're going to change it.
So, I just like the representative, but it wasn't a bill. I've been an advocate to make sure that whenever possible, the family members are included, that goes to grandparents, aunts, and uncles. Sometimes families are so dysfunctional, they don't get it right yet. But sometimes they have a complete, affairs have not been completed to the satisfaction of the each and the family member. So, I just don't want to have a screen or hurdle that was. Now it's going to be hard for families to do this. And the other thing is on these papers, on the first piece of occasional energy, and so this is section 9, it goes from 18 years to 21 years. And I think I just need another context because we have from 16 to 18 emancipation potential, but from 18 on. So tell me why the change from 18 to 21.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't change any of the ages of consent or even any of the ages of obviously of foster parents that are already up to age 21. Section 9 does the same thing, is another version of the same thing that we've talked about before. We want you to continue to search for a suitable adoptive or permanent home for a child. That's the law right now. But that just means for somebody who's up to 18. We want you to do that for the child who's 19 or 20, but under the law, they're called a child by a person. So the only reason for the change there is we want you to do the for a permanent home. We don't want you to give up on a child once they turn 18. And so we want you to continue to do what you're required of again up to age 21, look for a permanent home.
Yes, of course, that quite often that youngsters just fall off and bite it. So I just wanted to hear that line. You know the rationale for that. So I appreciate that. Looks like you're educational. I think it's a good fix. But I think, for the most part, unless the department has any objections, I think that most of the things you have in here are good.
We may believe in all of these things. They want their caseworkers to do those things. Some caseworkers are too new to know that they're supposed to be doing all of these things. And so that's why we have the court double check. We're at the hearing, show that you are going to work to try and find a job to put them home. Or that you're adopting a kid out of foster care. Like you said, that's how I feel. So you're adopting a kid out of foster care when you're 19. And they're going to be homeless, or they're going to move in with a bunch of friends who are in a deal. Maybe you should only have shown friends and face interest to make the team kids in foster care against their will.
So you think about a whole new class of foster parents as well. Everyone's a fit to foster a child, whatever person chooses to do that, but the right is. Alaskans out there that say, from 1921, I regret to be in foster care during that time period because I'd love to be that person that helps ignite that that spark for education and be that safe place they get to come home to and those type of things. So I think that's exciting to think about. I remember when I really got to the hearings that you were part of on some of the young dancers. That those families had saved to take place in our community. We had 14-year-olds that had been pushed into strip dancing and cultural prostitution. But we brought in that scientist from MIT to talk about frontal development. And it still haunts me to think about what he said, which was fundamentally the frontal lobe of a sapien. At this moment, your development isn't fully formed until 25. Your course insurance actuaries know that, and that's why the 25-year partnerships right there now, but there's so much that happens between the proverbial age of majority and 25. And, you know, but for the reason that all of us, how do you get to move again? Early immigration. And just a couple more comments before we go to Dr. Gardner. I know you mentioned the UC Foundation of your Academy's Foundation for some of the educational parts, and that just from the Office of Foundation. I think this bill might help you as sort of an opportunity to explain what you're doing, the rights there and here. And it's always certain how many Americans are willing to go to the Peace Corps, are willing to adopt families. In Nigeria, South America, we have all kinds of church roots and families that do that. And yet, right here in Alaska, we have some of the most poor and most disadvantaged children. And I just don't think they realize the opportunity that's there. And so I'm excited to see what you build for this. And this bill might help start an investment in the front right. So, any other questions that come through the bill sponsor? Without it, I'm going to just the only other person we have, a Twisty Sports Camel. So, I'm going to just over a second. So, I'll have this camel forward if that's okay, and just explain the important support, you know, or places you don't support, so you know, and fix them. Madam Chair, my name is Tracy Sparks, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Office of Children's Services, and I'm here today in support of HB 3127. We have worked very closely with the bill sponsor on the provisions of this bill, and we believe very firmly that what this bill offers is, yes, the sponsor has stated, a double check on our workers and ensuring that the work that they should be doing is occurring, and that one of the steps are occurring at the court level. There's additional provisions, for instance, the reasonable efforts are now being added to our pregnancy report, so that will be something we will actually have to report to the court on. In addition to whether or not the older youth are exiting here, there will need to be a report that actually outlines that those youth are ready and prepared to leave here. So we're very much in support of this bill. We certainly recognize that this bill matches a lot of what we have in our current practice. But we believe it also aligns many of our federal mandates with our statutory requirements, which is one of the things that we really appreciate here because it allows for us to think similar to our mandates, better state law. So that's another area that we're really supportive of as well. I do want to come back to just the issue of placement changes and how much we really put a value and an effort in finding relevance at every step of the way in our process. We want to start with that at the very beginning. We often talk about first placement, best placement, and that being with the relative. That doesn't always happen with our children, but that's what we strive for. And so every time we are looking at placement changes, we want to start with our relatives, and this bill just reinforces that. And certainly, looking at what we do have to do with placement changes, and we're also looking at the educational support of the center and to the owner, and as a result of the master to the bill. So, we recognize that this money budget that's being presented here in the bill is something that we're already doing, and for that reason, we believe very firmly that these are things that the states are going to absorb in our current budget. So, we have presented a zero baseline amount for this as well. So, with that, I am ready to take any questions.
Okay, how much is the program?
For Lucas Allen,
for Lucas
Allen. Thank you very much, Ms. Jim. We appreciate it. Okay, do you have one other person online? Amanda Nitidio with Facing Foster Care in Alaska. If you put yourself on the record and offer testimony, please.
Hi, I'm Dr. Amanda Nitidio. I'm the director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. I'm also a member of Foster Child, primary foster parents, and a social worker at the university. And I just have this on behalf of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. I'm so supportive of this bill. This is something that families from throughout the state have been asking for some time, and I've heard that provisions of this bill have been really requested. Over the biggest one is the continued search for permanent living families. We believe that the best thing we can do is get youth out of the foster care system and get to homes with people who care about them and the impact of the people in the community, because we know the state doesn't have the capacity to do all the things that young people need. Actually, in the budget plan, I personally am right now, who has moved through 47 different foster care placements. She's been with children for about 12 years now. And so I think that this legislation would help give us certain standards in terms of continuing to search for a permanent family or even relatives. And so I don't have to go too much of my concern that the committee is pretty heavy putting the shoes, and I can make that help available for questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Amanda, your daughter came to camp, I think you were here too, and I just wanted to say she's amazing and just quite a young woman, so poised and such a good advocate for kids in foster care in Alaska. Sorry I'm getting a chance to come to my office. This is me, I'm so by the way. I just wanted to just say that about her. She's really doing great, and I think
She actually is Rachel, so she went down every year because she has a lot of prayers with the team on foster youth. And so one of her highlights is where she goes, I need to go see me, and we need to get another comeback photo. It's a little bit of a year. It's pretty cool around the wall, and it's in her bedroom. She documents that each year.
Well, thank you, Ms. Mateo. We appreciate it. Now we're going to go to any other one in the any other person in the audience wishing to testify. We'll hear from online. Okay, hearing and seeing them, we would like to post public testimony. And I'd like to ask Representative Guerra and Ms. Porter to come back before us so that we could have a motion to adopt the committee substitute and then just say if there are any material changes from your original testimony. So,
I'm sorry, I move that we adopt as our working document the SAPS years and years as a substitute for Hospital 47, version S, dated 4/5/16.
So, Representative Guerra and Ms. Power, any changes in the committee substitute? Any additional changes you want to add to?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. There was one change from the House to the Senate, and that was an amendment on the House floor by Representative Wilson and Representative Dennis. We worked with them, and we worked on new language on that amendment in the Senate, which they didn't need to, and that was a minor change. But, the provision of the bill that requires your school support, they wanted to make sure that was even saying about that on child's best interest, they wanted to ensure that the stakeholders of the child's life were involved in it. The way the amendment was written in the House floor, that they have required a number of additional meetings that OCS doesn't organize at this point. And so what we did was we said, in determining whether school stability is in the child's best interest, we'll just fold that into meetings that are happening in most of the big communities already, which are these things called team decision meetings.
Is that place in the bill as you're talking about the issue real quick?
Sure.
What are you doing right
now? Yes, that's a bad image. Is that on the phone? Page 7, lines 13 through 16. So we've added at these team decision meetings, which I've been in. So you're not going to worry about keeping track of the same school unless your energy is good enough and has a lot of schools. And most of our communities, there's one elementary school, one high school, and Anchorage and the Valley and Fairbanks and Chino, those are basic places. If you're not having that knowledge from the secret school, the same thing. But those are really big things. We had team decision meetings in Valley, in Anchorage, in Fairbanks. And this is where you bring in everybody who's really interested in a child's life to try to make decisions, especially when a placement change is happening. And when that placement change is happening, we're asking us to address the issue of these things, keeping the child in the same schools in the child's best interest, or letting them move to another school, during kindergarten,
probably don't have a search curriculum in kindergarten that you could probably move to your age group school in kindergarten without real government. It's not for me to say, but maybe you'll bring this issue up at the team decision meeting where the foster parents are, or the national parents, if they're participating, are. We're in the toss on it if there's a toss that it is. Bringing up items that sometimes they can, sometimes they're not able to, that their case load is too high, I'd say. But all the people need to do the whole thing, and when they agree to that, this issue of school stability is not in the child's best interest to those team decision meetings. It's less, I think, what we do send some team decision meeting models to why they've been able to extend it to the national and to Fairbanks and to Anchorage at this point.
The substitute has been adopted before us as a working draft.
I'm sure we will be hospitals may certainly completely individual recommendations saying the text of the school.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? The hearing is seeing none, and the Senate CS for CS. The response is substitute for us number 27/S for the individual recommendation. Okay, that brings us to House Bill number 308. One change at the beginning of the agenda is to bring folks up next because he has been in the room. So let me know if you have a great time. I'll come to some user, but it tells you now. She's in judiciary on the House side, so please accept her apologies that she's not able. Really quickly about HB 308, this bill is a bill to help limit liability for those who volunteer as car seat technicians who want to make Alaskans safer and save lives. One is a technician in IASC, a general passenger safety technician, surveys a car seat to determine if your child is in the correct car seat, whether the car seat was installed accurately, whether your child is secured properly in the car seat, and whether or not your car seat has been recalled. So we have pretty high statistics in Alaska, unfortunately. In 2015, 89% of the inspected car seats in Alaska were incorrectly installed. And so it's vital that we encourage technicians to continue to take the course. It's a long course, 3 to 5 days, so it's not something that you can pull right on the internet kind of course on how to install a car seat. So if you would mind, I'm sure I can go through the conceptual analysis.
Absolutely.
A restraint in the interest of time. Members, iteration we're talking about version A, and this is our first hearing. We also have someone who is an instructor and a technician online, and right now we have several people available for questions, but we can then list this for many people.
Okay, and then I like to just tell the members so they know what their lifelines are official. We have Anthony Green with State in Fort Wayne, Sarah Penniston with Providence Medical Center, Christine Powell with the Norwich Fire Department, James Ellen with State Camps out of Camp Peninsula, Mary Carberry out of the Department of Law, Nate Wallace from Legislative Legal, and Corliss Taylor, who's the Alaska Child Passenger Safety Coalition representative. And again, none of these have signed up to offer specific testimony, but rather they're online to receive questions.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'll breeze through this, and if you have any questions, just let me know. So this is, this bill is referring to adding new statute in section 1, which is on the first page. It provides that the following are not civilly liable in the case for an act or omission that occurs in the inspection, installation, or adjustment of a child safety seat. And you have to be a certified technician. You or offering this to the community in a non-profit manner, and this also would provide liability immunity to someone who is operating a car seat equipment, a to the fire station in Barbsville, who owns the property. So the technician was offered the insurance for free, or in full cost and in good faith within the scope of their training. And the mail is not sponsored by the town passenger safety device manufacturer, so the folks in the proceeds do not apply to the community. In section 2, which is page 2, section 2, line 24, is referring to amending the current statute. So this was added on the House floor on Sunday. This is an amendment offered by Representative Lowell, and immediately Representative Rulup signed off in support. And this just basically changes some of the current statute to better explain the weight of a child who is in need of a booster seat. You may not transport a child under the age of 16 in a vehicle without securing them safely. A child less than 1 year of age or a child 1 year older who weighs less than 20 pounds should be properly secured in a rear-facing child seat. 1 or more years, but less than 5 years of age who weighs 20 pounds or more shall properly be secured in a child restraint device. Over 4 years of age, but less than 8 years of age, who is less than 57 inches in height and weighs 20 or more pounds, less than 65, shall be properly secured in a booster seat, which is kind of challenging for me when I get started transitioning from the rear facing to the front to the booster seat. So it is kind of confusing. This amendment offered by Representative Lowell is simply just clearing up that confusion. And then lastly, section 3, which is page 3, line 18, is the applicability clause that basically this passage in this act, law applies to the action that occurred over after the effective date.
Questions? Thank you for presenting the bill. So, do you happen to know why school buses don't need to provide safety belts for kids?
I think that would be a fantastic question for my friend Sarah Pinson, who's a nurse and a coalition coordinator for products. She's our bus advocate here in the state district, I believe. So, Sarah is online.
Okay, Sarah, can you answer
that
question?
Sarah, I just want to check for how that could be done at the time. I used the person, but also the term about the bridges and broken on the government's presentation to your comment. And with respect to the question regarding the details of school buses, we traditionally include the building from the system based on the assure that the buses are 8 times safer as the child faster than the and faster than the adult, and that statistic has not changed. And some of us on the line today have just returned from the National Safety Conference and have learned that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is currently looking at new requirements for school buses that the commissioner just last year announced that school bus safety is one of its priorities. And so we do believe that there will be some changes in recommendations for school buses. Traditionally, they have operated on a compartmentalization model, which is kind of like eggs in the egg crate. If a student just gets forward in the other seat, then there's supposed to be a different model. There has been any frontal collision. However, we hear about school bus rollovers most dramatically in the media. And in that case, the egg curtain doesn't necessarily protect them as well. So I would anticipate that we'll be seeing some vast changes in school bus safety recommendations in the next few years. Sorry, I don't have more firm information for you, but that is kind of where it stands at this time.
So thank you for that. I found that encouraging that we're looking at that, and certainly eggs are very fragile, and so are children, and it's just something that has brought my mind lately, and in relation to the accident we just heard about just recently, and we want to make sure that in all cases the lines are safe, so we never understood why there was such, as a parent, you're allowed to leave the hospital with the infant without someone coming and checking the car seat. And
also thought that if you have boys, you really look like you store the Legos. But, you know, I've always wondered about that, keeping your on the buses. So thank you for that answer.
Any questions?
Anything further?
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and set this bill aside. And bring up just in time before you leave for us, if you could just go ahead and give us, thank you, the presentation on to get it on the record. I don't know if I'll be ready to move today either, but we're going to get everything out at least in the queue. Okay, so you are going to go to the perfect place on the record.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lewis Wolf, staff center choir, and I'd like to thank you for getting us on Bill 212 this afternoon. As many people, I'm here that does one thing. I said that prevents law enforcement from seizing private property to a citizen unless the citizen has been charged with a crime. So, law enforcement has become a significant problem with law enforcement agencies seizing private property from civilians, regardless of whether or not they were charged with a crime, much less actually convicting anything. This has led to a labor reform across the country, and SB212 is a step in the right direction to ensure that this is not happening in the state of Alaska. That's pretty much my whole testimony number right now. It's a pretty simple bill. We'll put some in answer questions. We have the Department of Law, Craig Sullivan, John Seymour, and Andrew Lipson, people online, and Megan Wallace as well. Thank you again for being SB212 this afternoon. I'm going to ask you to support that and to get the Department of Law license.
Excellent. Okay. Questions, Mr. Wolf, committee members?
Senator Kyle? Question first. Can you let this be down again? Are there any
questions? I'm not that more of a question because I'm not exactly 100% part of the United States. Perhaps Kyle Wallace can give us a little information on that. She's
Ms. Wallace? Thank you for all your work this session. We appreciate you as your lawmaker team. We appreciate all of your drafting and hard work, and we hope you'll be able to rest on it too.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Conwell, Inland is a action that is brought against a piece of property as opposed to a vested person.
That's my thought, but I remember that for sure. So that's it. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay. We have Peter Sandberg on the line and Major Bernard Chastain. Mr. Sandberg, just for our testimony, it's in about 212. This is my first time hearing the bill over here on the Senate side, so I'm just familiarizing this with the issue.
Okay, my name is Peter Stanford, and I'm a private attorney in Research, Alaska, and I work with Dan Ingleton, Fitzgerald, who I've been in Fitzgerald, who is also active on the House side. So, the latest bill, and basically, the House helped us see that I was on a very large bill that was going to be a comprehensive fixture of forfeiture proceedings of all kinds in Alaska, and eventually the time constraints that possibly broke down to this much smaller. So, there's several different forfeiture. I think if you talk to Mr. Stigler, who will tell you that the answer is up here, I don't know. One way or another, because nobody keeps records of this way, I can tell. There is cases from back in the late 90s, or
Mr. Skipper. Questions, Senator Lucchesi?
It's hard to figure out where this bill's coming in.
A vehicle, whether it belongs to a municipal city or state land,
1% of the perjury to Class C felony. But if someone burns the boss's car in the company parking lot, or burns an ex's car in a driveway, that's not arson. Article 97 looks to close that particular option. It looks to charge those people who would use fire as a weapon, aimed at someone in payment to the litter or livelihood their transportation, to charge that person with the Class C felony of arson in the third degree. The status quo, if someone runs a vehicle that belongs to a private property, they can be charged with criminal mischief in the third degree. Well, it's also a Class C felony. There's nothing in that conviction to indicate that this is a person who uses fire as a weapon. And it has a different effect down the road in terms of someone's vehicle being licensed to the security guard in the state of Alaska, or your ability to care for and be licensed to care for vulnerable adults, vulnerable children. Those are things that the state of Alaska or employer needs to know. And so that's why Senator Regan brought forward Senate Bill 97. It has an extensive sexual analysis, but I think I'm going to go. That's our single page. I'm sure I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Excellent. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. You know, one of the things you learned early on in law school, and you know, in criminal law, there are a couple of early indicators of very deviant antisocial behavior that can lend itself to sociopathic tendencies in brain. Person is one of those. Torturing individuals is the other one. So it's just such a wanton disregard for life and property in the arson. So I didn't realize this was a loophole. And my understanding is, again, if it's your property and you're burning out your, it is your vehicle or your something, I don't know, if you're burning out your own property, that is not a part of what we're getting at in this bill. So just to be clear, you have to be the mental intent. It also has to be that you are not only the person meeting the mental intent, but you are not the owner of the property or someone else's property.
Madam Chair, correct. So the Article 3 statute, as it currently remains, was created in 2008. I checked the history of all three of the members who were in the legislature at that time and supported it. There was either a particular situation that had gotten out of control in the city of Alaska. It was, as a matter of fact. Senator Regan met with Senator Schultz before producing this bill. Senator Schultz feels that this bill was a pretty successful piece of cleaning up that situation. And he was supportive of the notion of applying this this legislation, this associated crime, Article 3 degree, to burning a vehicle that does not belong to you on private property.
Okay, and when we look at starting my final question, starting a fire or causing an explosion, those are defined, I would assume. I mean, they're concepts, definitions that you could anticipate. I'm just trying to think about, and then the mental intent would cover that. If you had an accident, if someone's hands were close, say fireworks or something, you could just be mental intent.
Intentionally, damage is limited by starting and closing. And this is the status quo language that exists in all of our existing arson statutes, and there have been many successful prosecutions. I'm sorry to say, successful prosecutions that exist in language.
So, of course, I have to mention that the one disregard for life when you think about seasons where we get a tremendous amount of sunshine and then the flame, where you might, one misnomer of time is here and then it spreads on and your damage is bombs and the sockeye fire is just awful. Just think of that one as an example.
Yeah, call our risks to starting fire if our significant and Senator Reagan's volunteer firefighter was particularly concerned about risks to our fleet responders. In case of vehicle fire, a lot of those chemicals go up, and the risk of things like water bumpers often are designed to compress when they overheat, they can just pop and go off dramatically. And so it's a significant risk to first responders as well. It would be called if someone's burning, phones are caught in flames.
So, any questions for Mr. Dean? Would you have the bill sponsor, Senator Tucker?
Actually, the fire chief came in earlier in the year, and actually, as he came up, I would be surprised.
Excellent. We just have one other person to testify, Mr. Dan Jager, with the Alaska Association of Fire Arson Investigators. And now, I'm going to have a testimony and have you come back before us. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Fire Marshal at the Camp Pacific Fire Rescue Team. I'm also on the Southeast Region Board Director for the Alaska Association of Fire Hazard Investigators. Our group is one that has really pushed forward on this to try to get some changes made to it. We already know it appears that there's some sort of maybe type of loophole or some unforeseen consequences in the original intent of the bill. And we're presenting this to clarify further fire investigators across the state and to, again, properly charge people who are responsible for committing a vehicle arson.
Any questions for Mr. Jager? Okay, hearing and seeing none, anyone in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill number 187? Anyone on the line I've overlooked wishing to testify? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that brings Senate Bill 187 under the attack in force. The amendments are free discussion. Okay, there's a motion on the table to the Senate Bill number 187 with individual recommendations. Is there a fiscal note by the Senate Judiciary Committee? Is there an objection to that motion? The hearing is seeing that Senate Bill 187 moves. That brings us now then to Hospite, and I do see Representative Hughes here in the audience, and I know that she's accompanied by Jennifer Blaisdell. The two of you would come forward, put yourselves on the record, and just explain so the public knows and the committee members know the compromise was up between the substitute of you and have this discussion. This is the bill that we had up already in committee, and there were some concerns raised by two of the members. They've been working with Becky and Ryan, with your patient, Shelly Hughes, representative from the other side, and my understanding is in reach of court. And they'll present that to us today. Senator, so would you like to make a motion that we adopt version L?
Madam Chair, I move that the committee adopt version 29-LS00055-3 is working on.
So is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing that we have the man in front of us.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Shirley Hughes, State House Representative for District 11, Palmer, with the Institute of Blaisdell. I do very much appreciate you bringing the bill back up. The seniors throughout the state have been very eager. It's been a top priority for several of the groups, and we've worked on this bill for 3 years, and I appreciate the input and working with Senator Costello and did you can explain the changes if you'd like. So there's a two-page document provided that gives a quick explanation of the changes. And I believe on each person's desk is a redline version so you can hear the five of those changes. On page 5, lines 2, 10, and 13, the number of days for a business to consider accepting or certifying the power of attorney was reduced by 2 days in the beginning to accept it and then submit to and act upon that certified document. So it reduced the agent's rate for an approval of the power of attorney
to 2 weeks or less. On page 7, section 5 is eliminated, and this is a complaint amendment, so that the Congress training language is the same as the recognition of sensitive disability can happen in sexism, section 27 of the bill. And in the bill is then renumbered because section 5 is removed. Any comments or questions for either the bill sponsor or the bill sponsor's staff? Thank you.